Our guest this week is the opinion editor of Newsweek, as well as a podcaster, constitutional lawyer, and rising young conservative thought leader. At 32 years of age, he's already made a huge splash within the print news community, and now I expect he will be doing the same in talk media via radio and podcasting. An outspoken conservative, this extraordinarily bright young man opines on conservative intellectual trends, contemporary domestic and foreign policy debates, constitutional and legal issues, and the intersection of law, politics, and culture. He's been published by many leading outlets, including the Los Angeles Times, the New York Post, Newsweek, the Daily Wire, and way more than I have time to list. He's a college campus speaker through Young America's Foundation and a law school campus speaker through the Federalist Society. Prior to Newsweek and the Daily Wire, where he was an editor, he worked at a large law firm and clerked for a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. He also served as a John Marshall Fellow with the Claremont Institute. He graduated from Duke University, where he majored in economics, and from the University of Chicago Law School. Our guest this week is Josh Hammer. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, the Podcast One app, and Spotify, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with Newsweek's opinion editor, Josh Hammer. Josh, it's nice meeting you. You and I have never spoken before. You have such an interesting background. I grabbed the opportunity to have you as a guest. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview. Certainly a pleasure to meet you.
Michael, great to meet you as well. It's great to be on with you.
You have a number of credits to your activities. You are obviously a very busy person, but one of them is that you are the opinion editor of Newsweek magazine. I've got to ask you, what is the function of the opinion editor of Newsweek magazine?
Sure. So I do wear a lot of hats. You know, I think my mother would be happier if I shedded some of them for my own mental sanity. But you know. It's all good stuff. So yeah, look, Newsweek opinion editor is my main day-to-day job. I've been doing this now for almost 2 years. Hard to believe, my God. Yeah, I started at the beginning, kind of towards the beginning of COVID. So I run the op-ed section. That's what I do. I have three deputy editors who work for me. I hired all three of them. We run the opinion section for Newsweek, obviously, which is a classic name in American journalism, literally founded at the depths of kind of FDR, Great Depression, New Deal era. And we put out an op-ed, you know, a series of op-eds every single day. Our mission is to fulfill the entire political spectrum. Newsweek, under its current management, has kind of adopted the motto, freedom to disagree. If you actually go to the mission statement on the bottom of Newsweek.com, we actually say explicitly, Newsweek speaks to and listens to readers across the political and cultural spectrum. And it's pretty rare to have, like, an op-ed editor like myself, who is publicly and unabashedly conservative and not kind of like a country club, you know, Rockefeller Republican kind of conservative, but like a real kind of culture war, culture centric conservative. So we're fulfilling the entire political spectrum. You know, we're publishing hard hitting conservative content, but also plenty of moderate and left leaning content that I don't personally agree with, as long as it's good opinion journalism. So it's been a fun ride.
Well, that is certainly a great answer. You answered about three of the questions I was about to ask all in one fell swoop, and I love it. I was going to ask you, wait a second now, Newsweek is not known as a conservative publication, or has that something happened that I haven't noticed? Can it work? Can a news platform in 2022 appeal to a spectrum of political opinions at this point? I certainly hope it can. Because I love that idea of a platform being open to the whole spectrum of legitimate points of view. And it's so rare these days. Everybody plays to the choir. I call it the daily dance of affirmation. So what's your experience with this bold experiment?
well, the daily dance, or however you formulated that.
The daily dance of affirmation.
Quite perceptive, I would say. So, look, I mean, based on – and Newsweek had a great year last year. I mean, you know, without divulging any kind of, like, private or sensitive information, mm-hmm. the company had a fantastic year last year. It's really only continued to grow in as far as readership, subscriptions, ad revenue, basically all the metrics that would define a business. It's really only kind of grown over the past few years. So based on all the data and the metrics that I see, the answer to your question is yes. You know, Harvard Business School, if I'm not mistaken, is actually doing a case study about how Newsweek has kind of resuscitated what the Moribund brand and has been so successful the past few years. So it's a really kind of interesting little success story, and we're happy that, you know, the Harvard Business School in the case study is going to tell it there. And, you know, on the opinion section itself, when I took over, you know, at the time, there were only kind of two editors there. I kind of came in as their boss. Now we have kind of a full five-person, or I guess four-person editor team. We might be looking to expand even from there, which is, you know, kind of crazy, but it's a good thing. And we think that we've tapped into something. We really do. I mean, you know, there are obviously competing silos in media and journalism in the United States. Conservatives tend to read their friendly publications. Liberals tend to read their friendly publications. Very few people are trying to do what we're trying to do. So it very much is, or at least was, a void. And we're really seeking to fill that void. So we feel pretty good about what we're doing. And even more so than just the written content. You know, for most of the past year, I guess we launched it last March or April, I guess it was, you know, I was co-hosting for a while a podcast on Newsweek called The Debate. Mm-hmm. And the Debate podcast is exactly what it sounds like. You know, me and a kind of liberal-leaning co-host would have on two people, one right of center, one left of center. And we would just hash it out. We would just kind of take on like a hot-button issue, you know, critical race theory, homelessness, immigration, China, whatever, like all the relevant issues, mm-hmm. and just kind of get it out there because so few people are hosting these kind of crossfire style conversations. So we feel pretty good that the business model is working at this present time, and it's been a really cool success story.
Were the conversations civil, or did they get out of hand?
Typically civil, I would say a couple of times they were a little more heated. Some guests, you know, have a tough time avoiding ad hominem, or, you know, some guests, especially some of the, maybe the, especially some of the left of center guests, may well play the kind of, you know, you're a racist card a little too frequently, that kind of stuff. But they were typically pretty civil. And a recurring theme that we noticed over and over again on that podcast back when I was hosting it is the guests would oftentimes get to a place of agreement both quicker and easier than they might have anticipated, which was really fascinating to see that play out.
Well, that's good. I mean, that gives us hope. I mean, it's very good to have points of view, and obviously there'll always be a left and a right. There's a left and a right to everything. I often tell my friends in radio that if the left were to disappear, or if the right were to disappear, whatever's left would suddenly have its own left and right. It's the way of nature. It's very hard to get more than two people to totally agree on anything, and then it becomes, you know, relative as to who's to the left or who's to the right. I want to get more into the podcast, and I know you have a new podcast is going to be launched called The Josh Hammer Show, but I want to just touch on a couple of more things about Newsweek, and then we'll move on to some of the other issues. Newsweek, you know, the name Newsweek, and then you mentioned, of course, there's a website, and that means there's a 24/7 news operation going on. What's your view of the whole idea of a print publication in 2022 dealing on a weekly basis? I know in the radio trades and the media trades, which I've done a lot over a number of years, it became increasingly difficult to put out a print copy, even daily newspapers have problems. So what's your assessment of that trend in terms of print and weekly?
So we are in print. So Newsweek has an interesting history, right? So from 1960 to 2010, it was owned entirely by the Washington Post. The Washington Post sold the company in 2010. They went through a couple of rough mergers, one with the Daily Beast from 2010 to 2013. I think it was around that time that the Daily Beast, under their ownership, I think, took Newsweek out of print. But our new owner and our majority owner and CEO, after he acquired the company in 2017, I believe it was, decided to put Newsweek back in print. So, you know, we're not there 52 weeks of the year. You know, it's maybe 2 to 3 times a month or so, and it's probably overall a little thinner than it maybe was 50, 60 years ago, probably, you know, 36 to 48 pages as opposed to back in the day when it was probably 80, 90, 100 pages. But we very much are in print, and we think it's important. We think it's important to be in print. I think it's important as a beachhead for kind of brand recognition purposes. Any other, are there still to this day certainly are the kinds of consumers who are going to want to go to a traditional newsstand and pick up a print product. I mean, just thinking personally here, you know, I mean, when I was, I'm only 32 years old, but, you know, when I was growing up in the suburban New York area, I took all sorts of kind of commuter trains into New York City from the suburbs. And, you know, my father and everyone like him, they were just reading the newspaper, right? I mean, and like that very much kind of, I think, still something that you typically see, even in this age of smartphones. Like there are a lot of times and places where just like a print product. And it's not just a generational thing. I mean, I have like a lot of friends, even millennials, who genuinely prefer print. And like speaking personally as well, I mean, like on my coffee table here at home, I have 4, 5, maybe even 6 different print magazines on my coffee table that I kind of subscribe to. So it very much is still a thing, for lack of a better way of saying it. I feel pretty confident in that. And it's not just because some people prefer kind of the actual feel of the paper and the pages, although some people do prefer that more tangible reading experience. But it's also some of these publications are almost kind of artistic too, you know, pieces of art. And it's very difficult to kind of capture that in digital form. So I certainly do a ton of reading online, probably more so than print, but print's not going anywhere. And we're definitely very happy to be back in print.
You know, what you just said really strikes a chord with me. For many, I'm basically a broadcaster, and radio has been my main medium. But, you know, nowadays everybody is multi-platform because everything is blending into everything else. I don't even like to use the term radio station or TV station. I like to call all of these platforms media stations because every media platform has elements of audio, elements of video, elements of text and print and photos and all kinds of things. So it's a time of change. But when I was publishing print publications, you said a word that really struck me, and that is there's something artistic about them. They're a work of art. I really hear you. I miss putting together front pages and where the columns go and where the headline goes and paginating where the ads go and how the page looks. And I thought originally, going back to when the internet first popped up and publications such as mine and ones I worked at would have a website, and we were all trying to figure out how to do it, I figured, well, you just put the front page of a newspaper on the web, you know, and it would just look like, you know, the front page of the New York Times or Newsweek magazine, and you would just put it on the web. It just seemed like the logical thing to do. And that, boy, did that not work for reasons I still can't figure. But it is true that there is an artistic aspect to a print publication that is just different in digital. And I think it's even impacted sales. I think that it's cost media a lot of money in terms of advertising revenue, because there's something about investing in something that's on a page that feels more solid and more, I don't know, more real than something online. So I just want you to know, I completely agree with you and have experienced that.
It's well said, right? And, you know, I don't think Newsweek is making the majority of its revenue, obviously, from print. I'm not sure any publication in America, no, or perhaps even in the world, is making the majority of publication from print. But it's important. It's important for all the reasons that you and I just said. I mean, to take like one obscure print publication that I don't actually subscribe to, it's a little bit of a different niche than I would subscribe to, but it's a fabulous publication nonetheless. It's a new one called The Lamp. I don't know if you've heard of The Lamp.
I have not. No.
It's kind of a Catholic-centric, like socially conservative publication, mm-hmm. magazine. I think my friend Matthew Walter was one who started it. It's just gorgeous. I mean, just like from like an aesthetic, like it's literally like a work of art. I mean, like I've considered like subscribing to it like solely just because it's so beautiful. And like they have thoughtful content too, to be clear. I'm not trying to downplay that, but it's yeah, no, it's really cool to see that kind of stuff.
And the book publishing world faces the same thing. And, you know, I just think we're in a period of transition. I think it's going to last a while. So this is our era. But I think ultimately, it'll all be digital. And I think ultimately it won't even be in – we won't even hold it in our hands. We'll probably have it in chips implanted in our head. And we'll just see things in our minds. I mean, who knows where we're going? But books, I think, are destined to become tchotchkes. You know, it's really funny. You see all of these guys on television. Because of the pandemic, so many people now do the talking heads from their homes. And whereas TV networks and CNN and Fox and all of these big-time television companies would never have anything but the best visual and audio quality for any of their broadcasts, they began to get a little bit lax and go into people's houses. And it's interesting that everybody seems to have gravitated toward finding a place in their house in front of a bookcase. And the bookcase has become the new television set for remote broadcasting in an era where you could be sure most of those people haven't read any of those books in years, but they sure look good, don't they?
Well, let me just make one additional point, actually. It's not just that it looks good, and I agree with you that it does. There's a deeper point here. So one of the magazines that I subscribe to in print is First Things Magazine, you know, the conservative publication, fabulously edited by my good friend Rusty Reno. And they had like a little ad campaign in the magazine that I noticed. Oh, I don't know. I mean, it was last year sometime, maybe 7-8 months ago or something like that. And what it said was, I don't remember exactly how they phrased it, but they basically said, big tech can't ban this. And they can't ban this because it's a physical product.
Right.
So, the same way that Amazon Web Services and kind of, you know, the various oligarchs who control the internet can effectively, on a whim, effectively kind of just wipe out any trace of a digital outlet, that just obviously, for obvious reasons, just cannot happen to a print publication.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because one of the things we thought when the internet first came on the scene was this is going to be the foundation and the bulwark of democracy, because now everybody has a voice and everybody could, you know, inexpensively become part of the democratized media. And yet it's so fragile, as we're learning. And there are big platforms that control everything, just as there were big platforms in the analog era. There's something about the relationship between platform and content that also gets deep into media theory on a cellular level. You brought up something that I want to come back to, and that is the freedom of speech and the freedom to be able to publish and have a voice here in this new era. But you mentioned podcasts, and I do want to get this in before too much time goes by. I understand that you are going to be debuting your own podcast, The Josh Hammer Show, in the near future. What's the status of that? Is that still, you know, in the works?
It is in the works. It's very exciting, or at least I, for one, am very excited about it. So we're targeting a conservative audience. You know, I personally, in my own capacity, I'm very involved in all sorts of efforts to try and shape the direction of the conservative movement, try and shape the direction of the Republican Party as far as a, you know, matter of political philosophy, public policy. I'm a lawyer by background, so I kind of have all sorts of thoughts on the Constitution and things of that nature that affect how I view American politics every single day of my life. So we're definitely targeting conservative audience, especially those viewers who are familiar with so-called new right, which is kind of this kind of young, up-and-coming swath of conservatives who are trying to adapt to the new challenges that are quite different than those of 30, 40, 50 years ago or so. We're looking at a launch date of February 1st or right around February 1st. We're going to format it to make it available for terrestrial radio, and we're really excited to get going here. I mean, we're it's going to be probably a combination of monologues and long form kind of deep dive interviews, but really the bread and butter, the focus that I really want to emphasize is the future of the right and what conservatives can do to fight back against woke illiberalism and just these very different threats than I think a lot of right of center Americans kind of grew up facing. You know, the threats that we face are simply not the same threats that, you know, President Reagan faced when he was in office 40 years ago. And it's time to update the playbook in certain respects. So we're deeply excited for this. Yeah, I mean, my producer, Jesse Edwards, you know, he has a large resume of experience in this space. He's worked with Michael Savage, Laura Ingraham, Lee Habib. The show will be available via file transfer protocol as well. So we're super stoked for this. I mean, from my perspective, I guess, right? I mean, after the passing of Rush Limbaugh, there's been a void. I mean, there has been a void in kind of the conservative talk radio space. But this show, my own show, is it's not going to be a daily. We're not going to try to compete, you know, necessarily with like Mark Levin and Ben Shapiro, both of whom are friends of mine. I actually used to work for Shapiro. So, I mean, you know, these guys are friends. But we're going to take a slightly different focus here. It's not going to be kind of like a daily necessarily, like, here's what happened in X committee in Congress today, and here's why you should be upset about it. That's not that. The focus is going to be like a little higher level, like a little more kind of about the intellectual trends that are kind of driving the conversation, less about kind of the day-to-day partisan food fights, if that makes sense. But mm-hmm. we're really trying to pick up the void here. I'm a young guy. I'm trying to speak to conservatives from you know 18 to however old, but definitely I think a disproportionate focus on speaking to kind of the younger conservative crowd. So we're super excited. You know, it's going to be politics, law, and culture. That's what we're about.
Politics, law, and culture. Okay, I'm going to get back to that in a second because that's a very interesting intersection. But you said something funny about the filling the void left by Rush Limbaugh. You don't see yourself as being the person to fill the void, do you? Is that do you have delusions of grandeur?
I do not need to imply that. I mean, if anything, you know, I think you know, the Clay and Buck show, Clay Travis and Buck Sexton, are trying to fill that void. And Buck Sexton's a good personal friend of mine, so I would never want to step on Buck's shoes like that. But just, you know, in general, it's I kind of just meant to say that it's a bit of like a Wild West out there right now, right, yeah. In the aftermath of Rush. So a lot of people are trying to kind of just, you know, reaching for straws, trying to kind of just in that environment where kind of everything is up in the air and there are less kind of beachheads, there are fewer anchors of talk radio on the right. You know, I think it's
really, I have to push back a little bit on that. There are fewer anchors on the right in talk radio. The biggest complaint that the world at large has about today's news talk radio, which is basically my major beat in terms of our publication, is that there's too much conservative programming and not enough anything else. So I find that an interesting comment. Is that what you meant to say, that there are
there are obviously a ton of daily talking heads, no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. You know, again, I mean, like, and plenty of like massive names, obviously. I mean, Hannity, Levin, Gorka, Shapiro. I mean, like, you know, there's obviously tons of daily talkers, I guess.
And local ones, too.
I mean, right. Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, many of my favorite radio hosts whose programs I go on pretty regularly are local. You know, my dear friend Michael Berry down in Houston, Texas. I mean, Mark Davis and Salem and Dallas-Fort Worth. I mean, a lot of these guys are friends of mine at this point. But I guess what I meant was there was a void, because one of the things that Rush was able to do so wonderfully, I mean, he obviously was fundamentally a political animal, right? I mean, he was deeply involved with the Republican Party as a political vehicle. He spoke at CPAC. I mean, he was a political animal, but he was so crucial in, I think, defining for an entire generation what it actually meant to be conservative. And I see less of that. I feel like I see less of that from a lot of kind of the daily conservative talkers. And I don't mean that as an insult, obviously. So these guys are phenomenally good at what they do. But I think that's kind of the void that I'm seeking to fill.
You're very polite, trying
to define that for a new generation.
Yeah, you're very polite in terms of not wanting to step on any toes. But in fact, it's interesting that, you know, people think that all the conservatives are all buddies and all the liberals are buddies, when in fact, back to that daily dance of affirmation, the ones that you're really competing against are the ones that are on the same ideology. And I don't mean you personally. I'm just saying it's one of the funny things of how it goes. And I think you're going to find, as you go further with this, and you've probably already experienced it. Again, and I mentioned that term, the daily dance of affirmation. Sometimes it you don't know who's leading whom when you target an audience, in this case, young conservatives, or you target an audience of conservatives or target an audience of heavy metal music freaks, you know, and anything where there's a target audience, you do this dance with them that they sometimes turn on you and say, hey, you're not doing what you said. You're not conservative enough, or you're not heavy metal enough. And it's a funny dance. And I'm sure you've already experienced it. One thing I'm definitely sure is you're going to experience it going forward. And it'll be quite an adventure. Based on everything we're saying and your background, I think it's great that you're entering this arena on and yet another dimension. And that is, you know, doing a show. That could, in fact, become. I gather when you said you're formatting it so that it could fit terrestrial radio. So you're doing a podcast that'll be broken up into segments like a radio show, so that a radio station could take it. Are you going to do it in hour segments? Is it going to be a 1 hour show or 2 hour show? Because one of the nice things about podcasts such as the one that you're on now with me is it can be as long as I want it to be. Sometimes a half hour, sometimes 40 minutes. You know, whatever. How are you going to break it down in terms of its length?
So we're looking at a clean hour. Yeah, a clean 1 hour program is what we're targeting. Mm-hmm. But, you know, look, we'll see. My background in the media space is primarily in the print world. I just started co-hosting a couple podcasts about a year ago or so. I've been co-hosting two for the past year. I do a lot of public speaking and conferences on college and law school campuses. So the talking medium is newer to me than the writing medium, but I love it. I mean, I've been having a ton of fun with it. So, yeah, we're going to do a 1 hour tie it to terrestrial radio. That's what we're targeting. But you're right. I mean, like, we're looking at more of a hybrid than like a pure quote-unquote podcast because, obviously, you know, the podcast, you don't necessarily need to worry about clocking in at 49, 50, 51 minutes, whatever. But, no, we're going to try and get it real tight to about a one-hour clean radio programming timetable.
Yeah, radio is fanatical about time. I mean, sometimes, you know, when we're in production, it could take 2 hours to be able to get something to fit a two-minute space or to, you know, to make it all fit together. Otherwise, it falls apart. We're talking about the intersection of politics, law, and culture. And you mentioned those three words together, and I immediately think about Section 230 and all of the controversy that's going on right now with the First Amendment, free speech, censorship, the power of Facebook, the power of YouTube, the power of Twitter, the fact that they are not responsible as publishers but as platforms. Most of the people listening to this conversation are very familiar with that. I assume being a constitutional lawyer and somebody involved in this arena, you're familiar with it too. What's your view of how the legal world and our legislation, how's it doing in catching up to the technology that's changing so fast we don't have laws to keep up with it? Very much like in the old days when cars first came on the road, there were no motor vehicle bureaus or traffic lights. People were crashing into each other all over the place, and they had to have laws. Well, we seem to be having the same thing. What's your take on that big issue?
So the short answer is we're not doing well. So this is an issue that I'm pretty active in.
I imagine.
Of all the issues on my plate, this is one that I spend a lot of time thinking and writing about. One of my many kind of side hacks was actually volunteer as counsel and policy advisor with a small group called the Internet Accountability Project, which was founded by my good friend Mike Davis and basically just exists as a home for conservatives who are looking to kind of rein in big tech and, you know, advance both public policy and laws that will hold these actors accountable for what we think of as their many misdeeds. So I'm a vocal critic of the big tech platforms. Just in October, actually, I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan to debate someone named Carl Szabo, who works for NetChoice, which is kind of the trade group for Google and Amazon and those companies. I've written all sorts of essays about like the need to use antitrust to break up these companies. So we're not doing a good job to kind of keep up with what is actually happening in the world. And Section 230 in particular, when Section 230 was written in the Communications Decency Act of 1996, you got to remember, I mean, this is like the horse and buggy era of the internet. I mean,
right.
This was kind of like the wild, wild west. I mean, you know, we all had those kind of AOL, like dial-up modems. Internet was slower. Maybe 10, 20, 30 million Americans, the absolute most at that time, had internet. So the, to kind of use like the fancier term here, the telos, like the purpose, the animating spirit of what Congress had in mind when it passed that legislation was basically just to incentivize innovation, right? And that's kind of what they wanted to do at any and all costs. But big tech now has gotten away with the immunity provisions in Section 230 for way, way, way too long. And essentially what they're doing from a legal perspective is they've been given an immunity carrot without a corresponding stick. So they basically have legal immunity to censor as they please, which, by the way, is not a particularly authentic legal interpretation of Section 230, but let's hold that aside. That's the way the courts have primarily interpreted it. Mm-hmm. So they're given effectively free reign, plenary control to censor under Section 230, but there's no stick. So they basically are getting away with doing this, and in response, Congress is not mandating that they not censor. So there's a lot of intellectual momentum on this. It was last April, I think it was, Justice Clarence Thomas, you know, the most conservative member of the Supreme Court, had a really fantastic opinion where he basically was kind of talking a lot how I'm talking now and saying that there is no corresponding stick. We should consider common carrier regulation, which is kind of the fancy legal term for what that corresponding non-discrimination stick would be. I've also been a proponent of using old-school trust-busting antitrust, at least for companies like Amazon and Google that mm-hmm. are legitimate monopolists by any traditional sense of the term. So there's all sorts of specific policy remedies out there. But on Section 230, we're just not doing a good job. I mean, like the role that these tech platforms have and what they do is they control our public square. I mean, like they are the people who are monitoring our 21st century public square.
Yes.
And the fact that these are largely unaccountable actors out in Silicon Valley, these like Birkenstock wearing dweebs. I mean, it's crazy.
I hope you would feel the same way if it were the other way around as well, though. I do agree that the conservatives have had the short end of the stick in terms of bias by the big platforms. I mean, it's clear to me that that's the case. But I gather that as your voice grows and hopefully you will play a role in the changes that have to happen, obviously you want it to be fair for both sides, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the solution that conservatives are typically pushing for, I mean, this kind of common carrier non-discrimination that I'm talking about here, or just tweaks to Section 230 in general, the goal is non-discrimination. The goal is not to discriminate against liberal viewpoints. The goal is non-discrimination, so 100%.
Yeah, and accountability. Don't you think? I do, especially since they sell advertising that they take from radio and television, advertising that they take from, right. from publications. It blows my mind, Josh, that radio, TV, and publications have been so generous in supporting Facebook and supporting YouTube and supporting Twitter and all of these platforms who turn around and take their advertisers. It doesn't make sense to me. they're so enamored by it. You know, the power that Facebook has over broadcasters, it was given to them by broadcasters. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, there's some legislation on the Hill now about trying to fix the revenue issue that you mentioned there. Because, I mean, just as far as advertising, as far as digital advertising, I mean, like Google is a monopolist mm-hmm. simply on that issue. I mean, even like holding aside its search monopoly. So it's a huge problem. It is absolutely a huge problem. But the issue, the way that I tend to frame the big tech debate, or at least the way that I try to frame it, because as a lawyer, I'm constantly thinking about how to frame my arguments. I think that's, you know, there's a famous quote. So I actually, among the things I've done in recent years, I actually ghost wrote Ted Cruz's most recent book with him in 2020. I've known Ted for a while now. And it was his book on the Supreme Court called One Vote Away. And I've known Ted for a while. Ted, before he was a U.S. senator, he was a prolific Supreme Court lawyer, an absolutely prolific constitutional lawyer. And one of his favorite quotes that he always talks about and kind of motivated his legal career was he quoted the ancient Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu. And Sun Tzu famously said, quote, "A battle is won before it is fought, mm-hmm. and it is won by the terrain on which it is fought." So I'm constantly thinking about how to kind of frame my arguments in general. And the way that I try to frame the big tech argument is less one of quote-unquote free speech or quote-unquote censorship, because that's kind of low-hanging fruit. I think the higher kind of philosophical level arguments, like the real kind of meat and potatoes, this is an issue of sovereignty. It's an issue of kind of lowercase r Republican self-governance. I mean, who is dictating the terms of the public square? Back in the day, you know, in the 1700s, back when, you know, Thomas Paine was running around passing out his common sense pamphlet in colonial Philadelphia, we had legislation on that. I mean, whether it was from Parliament in the UK or obviously kind of the colonial government, that was who was controlling the public square. But nowadays, under Section 230, as it's been interpreted and under our various other laws in the space, we the people are no longer making the rules to govern us, to govern our own discourse. So it's time to kind of reclaim democracy from the technocratic bureaucrats at kind of a more fundamental level. It really is kind of a deeper and more profound issue than simply one of free speech or censorship, I think.
Oh, it's a very deep issue, as is democracy unto itself. You know, say we the people, hopefully the people will have the right education to be able to handle it. I mean, one of the reasons that throughout history, the American experiment was considered to be just that, an experiment that probably wouldn't work, was because the aristocracy felt that the average people are not capable of governing themselves. And sometimes, even today, I wonder whether or not they're right. And that's I want to slap myself when I think that. But it's a very complicated situation, and a lot of it goes back to education. And, of course, education is part of this argument. So I don't want to go down that rabbit hole at this point. You said earlier that you want to speak to young conservatives. What do you think is wrong with some of the direction that perhaps old conservatives have taken the conservative movement? What are the issues within the conservative movement in America in terms of what you think it should do versus what perhaps an older established version of it has done?
Sure. So, yeah, I love this question. I've devoted a large swath of recent writings and speeches to answering this precise question. So my reading of kind of the modern quote-unquote conservative movement, and when we speak of like the modern conservative movement, we're really speaking of kind of the post-war era, starting in like the 1950s with, you know, William F. Buckley's founding of National Review, and the political philosophy that motivated the early days of National Review was what the theorist Frank Meyer called quote-unquote fusionism. And fusionism was kind of just quite literally trying to fuse kind of traditional religious moral conservatives with kind of a, you know, free market laissez-faire ideology. The issue, I think, is that this fusionist consensus, and to the extent that it actually was socially conservative, it really was not very public-facing socially conservative. It was a lot more kind of trying to create the breathing room in a liberal society for the churches and the families to inculcate values. But this kind of generation of conservatives, I think, tried to steer away from trying to actually legislate morality, from trying to actually kind of advance and articulate its vision in the public square. It was kind of confined to the churches and the homes. So when you wed that kind of more private social conservatism with laissez-faire neoliberalism run amok, and like really kind of like run amok, I think if you look at kind of Nixon going to China and China's ascension to the World Trade Organization, you know, we've kind of given the rope to hang ourselves in a lot of ways here. And I majored in economics in college. Okay, I've worked in economic consulting. I believe in capitalism, but I believe that capitalism also has limits. And I think that we on the right have gotten too obsessed with fundamentalist laissez-faire, with kind of free trade, free markets at any and all costs, even if it's ultimately destroying the American heartland, if it is destroying the Rust Belt, if we're shipping manufacturing and supply chains overseas, if we don't even have the masks at the beginning of COVID to kind of, you know, to keep our own people safe, semiconductors that are very sensitive materials for our Air Force and Navy planes are being, you know, created in Taiwan. there's a problem here. And we've gotten, I think, too obsessed with liberal ideology, not kind of progressive ideology, but liberalism as kind of an end unto itself. And we need to get a little more comfortable, I think, with recognizing that whether it's kind of the rise of China, whether it's the rise of big tech, and the rise of big tech has, you know, that has happened with right of center conservative complicity in a lot of ways, obviously. You know, the American right definitely has itself to blame, among others, for the rise of these unaccountable big tech oligarchs. So we have to get a little more comfortable, I think, with actually pursuing the art of politics. You know, George Will, before he took a more libertarian-leaning turn kind of later in his career, one of his earlier books was called Statecraft by Soulcraft. And, you know, he was speaking in there about the imperative to actually kind of wield political power to try and legislate morality and ultimately try to pursue a vision of the good, something more than just cutting taxes and cutting regulations. So I think the issue is that America in the year 2022, it's not that we don't have, you know, enough liberty. We have plenty of liberty. We don't have enough order. We don't have enough structure in our lives. There is no semblance whatsoever of religion or God in the public square. There, you know, we're being fed total crap in schools. We're being told that America is systemically racist at the same time that, you know, school prayer was banned from the Supreme Court 60 years ago. So it's not going particularly well. And I unfortunately think that a lot of kind of the modern conservative movement, unfortunately, has contributed to this problem. I mean, it's been more of a problem at the left, but we really have kind of supplied the rope to hang ourselves on a lot of these issues, you know, especially issues like China and manufacturing and things like that. So we've got to get more comfortable actually using state power to kind of pursue our vision. And that's going to have a host of implications on, you know, cultural issues, economic issues. That's more or less the vision that I'm trying to articulate here. You know, some call it national conservatism or common good conservatism, but it's a fairly non-libertarian, a little more hands-on brand of conservatism, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, you know, libertarianism taken to its fullest, to its furthest logical, you know, extent, is anarchy. Let's go back to the jungle. So I had a conversation with a former presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party. It got really loose and crazy, and we're talking about stuff. And I said to him, I said, okay, so suppose you had a major intersection in a city. Are you saying that traffic lights in that intersection are unnecessary? That because that's a real microcosmic cellular level, you know, grassroots level example of government interference, government regulation. And his answer to me was it blew my mind. He said, "Yeah, I think that we don't need to have traffic lights." This guy ran for president in our lifetimes. I'm older than you. Your lifetime. Well, maybe not. Maybe it was right before that. You are very young and you're profoundly intelligent. It's remarkable. And he said, "No, I think we could do it." I said, "You think that people will be able to negotiate how to get through an intersection with cars without a traffic light?" He said, "Yes, if they were left to do it on their own, and you know, we expected them to be responsible." I said, "Well, that's a big expectation." So ever since then, that one conversation, Josh, had a tremendous impact on me. And isn't that basically what you're saying, that there has to be some type of fundamental law, order, regulation, planning, and accountability?
Yeah, we need rules. I mean, like, we as a society are not suffering from, like, a fascist regime where we are being oppressed by too many rules. We frankly need more order. I mean, the problem is that America is unraveling from within. It's unraveling from within for so many different reasons. I mean, among those reasons, obviously, is the decline in religiosity and then the decline in meaning and the rise of loneliness and despondency and the opioid crisis. But I guess, you know, my issue is that, or I guess my broader point, I should say, is that those maladies, those problems, from my perspective, can be directly tied to a lot of policies, not just that the left has pushed. I mean, the left has pushed any number of terrible ideas and policies. But even that some on kind of the more libertarian-leaning elements of the right have pushed here. I mean, my reading of China's ascension to the World Trade Organization is very, very bad. I mean, in retrospect, you know, Nixon's proverbial trip to visit Chairman Mao in Beijing in 1973 was probably one of the most stupid, I mean, for lack of a better term, just utterly foolish decisions that we could have possibly made. Like, we have torn apart the American heartland. We have destroyed so many good, well-paying union manufacturing jobs. And for what end? Like, to save a few pennies on made-in-China consumer goods? It just really makes no sense, honestly, right? So that is definitely kind of the perspective that I'm coming from here. It's, you know, it's more of a kind of like a nationalist. I mean, we might even say like paleo-conservative perspective. I mean, you know, I'm sure I have plenty of quibbles with Pat Buchanan. I'm not a neocon of foreign policy at all, but I'm probably a little more towards the middle than someone like Pat Buchanan is. But like, we can use the word paleo-conservative. I think that's totally fine. Someone who thinks that kind of, you know, cultural primacy and sustaining the culture from generation to generation is probably kind of the quintessential role of a statesman. But again, we're unraveling from within, and, you know, people are talking about, like, national divorce. The left hates the right hates the left. We don't even imbibe each other's media. We don't talk to one another. We're unfriending each other on Facebook. And it's because we don't have religion. The nuclear family is just completely breaking down, obviously. You know, out-of-wedlock birth rates are dramatically escalating. I mean, you know, back in 1964, when Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote his, you know, or 65, whenever it was, when he wrote his report on the black family, at the time it was a crisis that the out-of-wedlock birth rate, I think, was around 40%. I think that number today is over 70%. And by the way, it's not like white Americans are doing a whole lot better on that score. I mean, it's not quite as high, but it's certainly not good. So all of these problems, the remedy, the solution is not /regulation/regulation, more freedom, more liberty. That's what got us into this mess. We need more rules and structure.
How interesting.
So that really is kind of where I'm coming from as far as my vision of
it. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating full cycle situation that here you on the cutting edge of conservatism see restriction, restraint, structure, regulation as part of the solution. It just shows how fascinating and how complex these issues are. Final question. Let's bring it down to the world of dirty and, you know, downright dirty politics, left versus right, Republicans, Democrats, elections, and talk media. Okay, as a person who is concerned about the young people coming up within the conservative movement, about an intellectual high-level approach to conservative thinking, what's your take on Donald Trump?
Oh, boy. Yeah. So, look.
That's the last question.
No, it's a good question, of course. So, look, I mentioned that I've known Ted Cruz for a while, okay? So I was a huge Cruz supporter back in 2016. I ultimately did not vote for Trump myself in 2016. I obviously did not vote for Hillary Clinton, but I was kind of, you know, very, very loyal to Cruz. And if you recall how bitter that primary fight was,
I sure remember
myself at the end of the day to pull the ballot for Trump. I certainly became a big supporter of his. I mean, I supported the vast majority of the agenda that he sought to do, but not always the most effective at executing on his instincts. But his instincts were generally correct as president. I mean, certainly, you know, he has some accomplishments. I mean, like the Abraham Accords in the Middle East, the peace agreements with Israel, UAE, Morocco, and so forth. I mean, just incredible stuff. I mean, like, that alone would have won the Nobel Prize for literally any other president not named Donald J. Trump. And, you know, on the China issue, which I've mentioned a few times now, you know, he really was kind of the first president since Nixon's trip to visit Chairman Mao in the 1970s to talk about and advance some policies to kind of dispute this premise that the best way to kind of nurture political liberalism in China is to kind of welcome them to the family of nations. He was really kind of the first president to intuit that is BS, that is total nonsense, and that the time is right and proper for more punitive measures, be they tariffs or you know, all sorts of kind of you know, strategic alliances in the foreign sphere. So he really did kind of, I think, intuit a lot of great stuff. You know, having said that, The column that I wrote, and I write a weekly syndicated column. You know, you can find it at Newsweek, American Greatness, Daily Signal, New York Post. It's at a lot of places. The column that I wrote after January 6, 2021, was I basically said, look, at this point, if Trump cares about the movement that he helped spawn, and he really was necessary. I mean, as you can tell, I am less than fully impressed with the accomplishments of a lot of, you know, the elders of Conservatism, Inc., if you will. So I think as his force as a wrecking ball was deeply important, and I didn't quite see that at the time in 2016, but it really was quite necessary in retrospect. But after January 6th, you know, the column that I wrote, he's got to go away. And I kind of resigned myself that he probably won't, because he's Donald Trump, and if it's one thing that Donald Trump cares about, it's Donald Trump, so it's just not in his nature to go away. But I would strongly prefer that he go away. And, you know, I mean, look, I live here in Miami, Florida. I moved here a few months ago. I was up in Tallahassee just a couple weeks ago with seven or eight others. We had a really nice kind of off-the-record dinner with Governor DeSantis. So I certainly would love to see Governor DeSantis be president one day, but I do not think Trump is just going to walk away. It's just not in his nature.
And there you have it. An uninterrupted conversation with Josh Hammer, opinion editor of Newsweek, podcaster, constitutional lawyer, and rising young conservative thought leader. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you're interested in hearing my weekly 1-hour radio show, The Michael Harrison Wrap, check out mhwrap.com. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison, The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a production of Good Phone Communications, presented in association with Podcast One and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.